Morgan and Plummer versus Sherman. You're ready to proceed. Very well.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court, I'm Timothy Weiler. I'm here on behalf of appellants. This case concerns the proper application of the Superior Court rules. This court's review is de novo. I would respectfully submit that the plaintiff, Donette Plummer, has been denied her trial because the court below misapplied Rule 12 in granting the defendant's motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction, and because its decision in denying the plaintiff's motion for re-argument was an abuse of discretion and inherently unfair. The plaintiff's second complaint was filed on August 2, 1999, pursuant to the Savings Statute, 10 Delaware Code, Section 8118A. The plaintiff then attempted to serve the defendant through the Delaware Non-Resident Motorist Long-Arm Statute. During this time, the trial court repeatedly sent notices pursuant to Rule 41E, advising that the case runs the risk of dismissal because service had not been effected. Counsel diligently advised the court of the difficulty it was experiencing in locating the defendant as he was itinerant and had left Delaware. Essentially, there was no address to serve the defendant. The trial court then issued an order dated October 9th of 2001.
Before we go any further in the chronology, it appears from the record that the Secretary of State was served and then there was no subsequent mailing. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
One would have thought that when you're doing service with the Secretary of State, you would have anticipated that you needed to send out a letter and you would have determined where you were going to be sending the letter, especially since you only had 7 days to do it. But apparently, service was accomplished on the Secretary of State with no idea where the defendant was, and therefore no idea where to send the letter in 7 days. Is that correct?
I think that's essentially true and correct, Your Honor. I think that the plaintiff was doing what they could to effect the service. My understanding from a review of the papers is that there was no address whatsoever to serve the defendant.
Oh, yeah, but help the court understand the thought process here. You're going to be filing a lawsuit, and you're sitting in your office, and you know you're going to be serving the Secretary of State, and you read the statute, and it says, I'm going to have to be sending a letter in 7 days. And you say to yourself, well, I have no idea where I'm going to send the letter, and I have no idea where to find the defendant. So I'm just going to file a complaint and serve the Secretary of State, skip sending the letter since I don't know where to send it, and just kind of see what happens. Was that basically what the record reflects?
Well, I think it is true that at the time that the complaint was filed and service was initially attempted on the Secretary of State, there was no address for the defendant to be served. I believe it was the hope of plaintiff and counsel that they would come across a defendant address that would be viable and a place to be served.
And so what was the thinking as far as the 7 days were concerned? You know, if lightning would strike and we'd get the address so we could send a letter in a timely way, that would be wonderful. But in the event we find the defendant later, that's going to be okay anyway. Now, I guess that's where we are in the story, because you're getting these Rule 41 notices that nothing's happening. So help us understand why legally everything is all right anyway.
The plaintiff had certain resources available to them and had to go forward with what they had at the time to effect service under the long arm statute. There was no real any other way to approach it at this point.
So tell us what the Superior Court did that constitutes reversible error.
The Superior Court renewed, in a sense, a defense that had been waived by the defendant, because the issue of compliance with the long-arm statute with the seven-day notice provision to the defendant was not raised in either the answer or by way of motion before the answer pursuant to Rule 12. Having not raised that defense, lack of personal jurisdiction, it was waived by the defendant, and the case should be able to go forward.
Is that subsumed within the failure to prosecute defense that was raised?
No, we would respectfully submit that the failure to prosecute case is couched within the analysis in a Rule 41 type of analysis for delay in prosecuting the case. I don't think the actual defense of lack of personal jurisdiction was ever raised in the initial motion. In fact, I believe it was raised finally in a response to a response addressing the first motion for failure to prosecute.
Can I clarify something for myself? The court ultimately dismissed for failure to prosecute? Is that correct?
No, the trial court did not reach that ground in reverse, or rather in dismissing the case. The court reached its decision based upon a technical violation, albeit a violation of failure to send the notice to the defendant within the seven-day period.
Well, would the court have grounds to dismiss for failure to prosecute, forgetting the service of process issue?
It could, but it had not in repeated 41E notices on the docket during the pendency of the case prior to the answer being filed. Each time the court had the inherent authority to say, pursuant to 41E, I'm dismissing the case because it wasn't filed within the 7 days, or it wasn't served within 120 days, and it did not do so. It kept renewing the life of the case. Each time a 41E notice went out, counsel for the plaintiff responded, and at one point the court kindly said, okay, you have 90 days to do three things, or the case was a serious risk of dismissal. And the three things that the court ordered on October 9th, 2001, were fully complied with by the plaintiff within the time frame set by the court.
And those three things were what?
Those three things were, Your Honor, to open an estate on behalf of the deceased defendant, which now the counsel had just discovered that the defendant actually was dead, appoint a personal representative, and serve that personal representative. All those things were complied with by the court's October 9, 2001 order. And then the complaint was amended to include the substitute defendant, Sherman, who was the executor or executrix of the estate of the decedent. And she was personally served on January 2nd of 2002. Subsequently, counsel for the defendant entered his appearance in August of 2002 and filed an answer 4 months later in January of 2003. And then in February of 2003 was the motion to dismiss for failure to prosecute filed by the defendant, bringing us to the trial court's decision, and here we are today.
Did the notices under Rule 41 that this is going to be dismissed failure to prosecute if you do not accomplish service on the defendant give an indication or signal that a defense based on failure to prosecute could include failure to perfect personal jurisdiction?
Candidly, Your Honor, I've not read the actual notice. I have seen notices in other cases, and they are somewhat of a form notice that the court sends out indicating that there's been no activity in the case. And basically, as an attorney, I view that as an alert from the court in terms of a housekeeping matter as to what's going on with this case. And it's incumbent upon counsel to then respond to the court and give them an advisory or a letter telling them why the case is not moving forward. It's Rule 41 I view as a winnowing or housekeeping rule to make sure that cases don't stagnate and that the courts not burdened with them. So I can't answer your question that whether or not I specifically identified that as a potential problem with the case, but the docket is replete with responses from counsel to the trial court indicating the difficulties they were having with locating the defendant and serving him in that regard. The motion filed by the defendant styled failure to prosecute and requested relief under Rule 41. And as I advised the court did below did not base its decision on this argument of failure to prosecute, but rather dismissed it because the plaintiff failed to fully comply with the service and notice requirements of the Delaware long arm statute.
Well, does that cut the other way then? That the by not addressing the failure to prosecute, that the failure to perfect personal jurisdiction is a separate defense?
It is a separate defense. I believe that they're not exclusive, but the failure to affect the service, it would be the plaintiff's position was waived by not being addressed or outlined in the answer pursuant to Rule 12 or by a separate motion before a response of pleading was filed. So
is it your position with regard to the failure to prosecute and that when the Superior Court gave you this assignment of doing three things and you accomplished those three things in a timely way, you basically had a fresh start on the failure to prosecute because you were current with everything the court wanted you to do? And if that's the case, and then as I understand your argument, what we're really looking at is what happened after the administratrix was served and filed her motion to dismiss. Is that correct?
We would have the position, Your Honor, that we had complied with all of the requirements the court had outlined to keep the case alive and viable and moving along, and there was no failure to prosecute as a viable defense or reason to dismiss the case. And once the executrix was appointed and served, the only defenses that remain are those that are that would have been enumerated in an answer or by a separate motion pursuant to Rule 12. There were none, and therefore they have been waived. And it would be inappropriate for the court to revisit those defenses having been waived already by the defendant.
Are we clear, however, that had a timely defense of lack of jurisdiction been raised, it would have prevailed? In other words, there's no savings clause or other way that you get around the requirement that you follow up the service on the Secretary of State with a letter to the last known address.
From my reading of the case law, and specifically the trial court's prior decision on another case where there was another, put in quotations, technical violation of the long-arm statute, it would appear that Your Honor's supposition is correct, that had the defense been timely raised and presented pursuant in the correct manner pursuant to Rule 12, the plaintiff would be in a much worse position in terms of trying to argue that there was personal jurisdiction. As I said, Your Honor, Rule 12B clearly states how defenses are to be presented. Particular to this case, Rule 12B states that the defendant shall raise every defense in the response of pleading. In this case, that would be the answer, which was clearly not done, or by a separate motion within the seven, outlining one of the seven affirmative defenses within 20 days of service. Such a motion shall be made, Rule 12 says, before pleading, if a further pleading is permitted. So the defendant's position that they can make a motion after the answer has been filed raising this defense is not accurate under Rule 12. I see I running out of time here, Your Honor, but...
Well, you can continue. Yes. You're into your rebuttal time, but the clock is counting down. Do you want to save the rest of your time, or do you have some additional points?
I would just like to address the fact that the court, in working through its decision process and with counsel, permitted the defendant to raise this late issue of the defense of lack of personal jurisdiction. And when plaintiff's counsel attempted to re-argue the issue, raising the waiver issue, the court did not permit that argument to be advanced and basically precluded the plaintiff from raising the waiver issue in motion for re-argument. And then by way of dicta, said essentially that it's moot because if I had allowed I would probably have allowed the answer to be amended anyway to raise these defenses to be added on with an amendment to the answer. Plaintiff would respectfully submit that that was wrong as a matter of law because the answer cannot be amended without a leave of court, and Rule 12 does not permit the answer to be amended unless it's a matter of course, meaning...
Well, as I read Judge Kircher's decision, he issued his first decision adverse to your client, and then in the motion for re-argument, waiver was brought up for the first time. And Judge Kircher is saying, you know, I've already decided this based the way the parties have framed it, and now after I've decided it, you're raising this waiver issue for the first time, and it's too late. If you wanted me to address it, you should have said that in the beginning. If there's this great position that you have to assert waiver, is there an explanation in the record as to why it was only raised for the first time on re-argument?
No, I can't answer why it wasn't raised initially, but my only response to that, Your Honor, would be that the failure of the plaintiff to raise the waiver issue initially doesn't unwaive the waiver. The waiver existed when it wasn't in the answer or by a motion. And because the plaintiff failed to then raise that as an issue later on, it can't unwaive what's already been waived.
So we have dueling waivers here. The defendant waived everything that you want waived because they filed an answer, and you waived everything that the defendant wants you to waive because you raised it in a motion for re-argument.
And we would say that the first waiver by the defendant was by his own decision-making process by not following the rules, and whereas the denial of the assertion of the waiver defense by the plaintiff in the second case by the trial court was an abuse of discretion that the court should have let that in.
You have about 3.5 minutes left.
I'll ask to reserve that, Your Honor. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
May it please the court. My name is Thomas Leff. I represent the appellee, Sherman. Appellants argue that because a lack of defense of personal jurisdiction was not raised in its answer to the complaint below, the Superior Court had no basis to grant appellee's motion to dismiss, but I would most respectfully submit that this is a bit of a red herring in that under Rule 41, the court had plenary authority to hold that it lacked personal jurisdiction because service had not been perfected under the long-arm statute. By its own admission, plaintiff had failed to give the required 7-day notice that the long-arm statute requires. This is the 7 days after the return of service from the Secretary of State. Without proper service, personal or constructive, there can be no personal jurisdiction.
Well, let me stop you there because I'm getting very confused here. Subject matter jurisdiction is something that's always at issue. The court doesn't have jurisdiction. Nothing it does matters. Personal jurisdiction, on the other hand, is something that can be waived and is like other potential defenses, if it's not raised, then the court doesn't look into it on its own. The court doesn't say, well, wait a second, I know you didn't say anything here, but I'm looking at these papers, it doesn't look like you complied with the long-arm statute. Isn't that correct, that, you know, personal jurisdiction does not come to before the court unless it's presented to the court as a defense, right?
Well, that's correct to the extent that if there's nothing in the record presented or argued to the court related to that issue of service and its concomitant personal jurisdiction. But in this instance, in the motion, and I would submit in the affirmative defense we filed for lack of prosecution, the issue, the subject matter of lack of service and lack of personal jurisdiction, which go hand in hand with this failure in this instance to prosecute, were brought before the court and properly raised, and the records very clearly laid out exactly what those facts were.
So in other words, you filed a motion to dismiss for failure to prosecute, and you said the reason why this motion should be granted is because service was not perfected?
That's the substance of their failure to prosecute. They never even got past that step in order to proceed in any other respect with the advancement of the litigation.
Well, why would there be two different rules, one for failure to perfect jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction, and another for failure to prosecute, if one can be subsumed in the other?
Well, as I read the two rules, Rule 12B and Rule 41, there is an overlap in the court's authority to rule on these matters. And I quote just from Rule 41E, the very first sentence says, the court may order an action dismissed sua sponte upon notice of the court for failure of a party to diligently prosecute the action, comma, for failure to comply with any rule, statute, or order of the court, comma, or for any other reason deemed by the court to be appropriate. And in this instance, the court sua sponte dismissed the case based on the record before it and argued in oral argument that there had been a failure to comply with actually both a rule and a statute, the statute being the long-arm statute, which the court recognized had not been followed.
So if we rule in your favor, what we're saying is that notwithstanding Rule 12 that says you've got to raise lack of jurisdiction in your answer, right, which you didn't do. Notwithstanding what Rule 12 requires, Rule 41 can trump it.
If the court on its own initiative, recognizing the facts in the case, comes to the conclusion based on the record in front of it, that indeed it did not have personal jurisdiction because it, in fact, had never been perfected then through the proper service, then the court, I can see, on its own motion, as it were, make that decision.
Could the court do that if the other party said, wait a minute, we waived personal jurisdiction? And could the court say, well, you may want to waive it, but you didn't comply with the statute, case dismissed?
Well, my understanding would be that personal jurisdiction of a defendant could not be forced upon the court, even by agreement of the parties, if the court found in the record before it that simply personal jurisdiction did not exist. I think in that instance, that's where I think the court could step forward, based on a complete and full record, fully argued and briefed, in fact, that personal jurisdiction did, in fact, not exist, whether the parties, either the plaintiff or the defendant, had not properly addressed that. And in
how does the Superior Court get from your motion to dismiss to writing an opinion dismissing based on failure of service? And in no personal jurisdiction, did this evolve at the oral argument on the motion?
From what I see in the record and the transcript of the oral argument is enclosed in the appendix, plaintiff's appendix here. My understanding is the court discussed these matters. They came up in oral argument as well as in some of the briefing. In response to the reply brief that a defendant provided to the court, where personal service, the issue of personal service and personal jurisdiction was raised, the court granted the plaintiffs additional time for further briefing on that issue, and further briefing was supplied by both sides. So the court, in a sense, amended its own briefing process to permit the parties to address this issue, which came up in the course of the briefing. And so that's how I think they got to it. It was a little bit circuitous, but nonetheless, all parties were afforded the opportunity to address the issue, and they did.
Right. Well, then let's go back to your motion. And before there was additional briefing on that issue, following up on Justice Ridgely's question, it would appear, looking at the motion, that someone decided to enter an appearance, make a motion to dismiss, and concluded your best argument was, this case has been languishing, and it's languished so long that the defendant is now dead, and we shouldn't have to defend the case because of this failure to prosecute that was so lengthy. It even resulted in the death of the defendant, and now we're prejudiced. So you really thought that was a good winning argument?
That was certainly the first inclination of my colleague when he submitted that motion. And I think because the time that had passed was so long, it was over 6 years since the time of the accident before he even got to be served and knew about the complaint. And then after the time that the administratrix of the estate was served, there was another 8-month period where he was not informed of the suit in order to file his entry of appearance. So much time had passed, and there had been, as we learned, so many 41E letters issued about the tardiness and delay in the case that was what came to mind first, and that's how he decided to proceed. I think embedded in that, though, as I mentioned earlier, was the concept that, of course, the reason for all of this delay was a failure to serve, and therefore a failure to establish personal jurisdiction over the defendant. That's what brought the motion to dismiss to be filed, which was filed within a month of filing of the answer.
I'm having a little trouble here. The record seems to include the response to your motion to dismiss for failure to prosecute that goes through all the efforts that were made to locate the deceased. And then your response to the response, that's what it's called, which raises the failure to effect service under the long arm statute. And then you made reference to the fact that there were then supplemental submissions to the court because the court got interested in that point and said, okay, why don't we have some more briefing? I don't see anything on that in the record.
My understanding, and I think it's outlined in the docket, that after oral argument or during oral argument, the court proposed further briefing if the plaintiffs wished, and that was submitted. I'll find the date for you. In May.
Right, I see what it says on the docket, but that's not part of the record here?
I don't know that the actual briefing, the supplemental briefing that was submitted to the court was actually included in the appendix, but it did touch on those issues.
Okay.
A Rule 41 motion can be made at any time, correct?
I don't think there's any limitation particularly on the timing, although it would make sense to offer it sooner rather than
okay. Later. So if the case had gone to trial and post-trial under Rule 41, could this lack of personal jurisdiction have been asserted?
I would have had a little bit of difficulty with that because of the timeliness of it. It seems that if the issue is lack of personal jurisdiction or failure to prosecute, then surely I would think as a practical matter that should be brought up fairly quickly after all the parties are entered into the case. And
Rule 12 contemplates that, right?
Rule 12 does contemplate that. What Rule 12 does provide, though, is that, and Rule 15A provides that, as a case develops within reason and on motion of the court, you can amend your answers or any pleading in order to accommodate significant developments in the case that would affect your position. And under Rule 15A, as Judge Coote suggested in his opinion, that an amendment to change the affirmative defenses or add them certainly could be done, and he likely would have granted it if it had been done in a timely manner. I assume, though, that a timely manner would be reasonably early in the case before other things develop, which would cloud that issue.
So help us understand why the failure to serve the defendant during his lifetime is still important. Since the administratrix had been named, she had been served, and she filed a motion to dismiss.
As I understand the long-arm statute and the language of it, and it says in subsection A that where an action has been duly commenced under the provisions of this section by service upon a non-resident who dies thereafter, service of process and so forth should then be served again under the same procedures on the administratrix of the estate. But the statute says service upon a non-resident who dies thereafter, and I believe that language contemplates that there has to be service within the lifetime of the defendant in some form or another, whether constructive or otherwise, before service on a subsequent administrator of his estate can become effective. And that's what Judge Cooch referred to in his decision when he said, because service on Mark Foes, the defendant, the original, the decedent, had not been accomplished correctly according to the long-arm statute, then subsequently service on the estate, however properly it may have been opened, was not effective.
Help me with this hypothetical. Let's assume that Fossey, how's that pronounced? Is it?
I'm not sure. I just keep saying Foes.
Foes, all right. Let's assume Mr. Foes dies within the statute of limitations. He's out of state. He's got another creditor in Delaware. The other creditor opens an estate. And then the plaintiff in this case decides, well, I've got an option. I can either do the long-arm statute, where there's already an administratrix here in this state, and the plaintiff personally serves the administratrix. Does that constitute sufficient personal jurisdiction?
Well, if Mr. Foes, if the complaint had been filed, and but service had not been accomplished on Mr. Foes by that creditor, then I think he would have to go back through the whole process and refile the complaint.
No, I'm talking about a creditor who just wants to open an estate in Delaware because it doesn't look like there's going to be any estate open for the decedent anywhere.
They certainly may open the estate and serve the estate to make whatever claim they have. They have other requirements they need to meet, their statute of limitations requirements and so forth. I think if they could meet those statute of limitations requirements, or at least as they would relate to whenever the death of the creditor was.
Well, is it a correct response for the administratrix to say, sorry, if it's a motor vehicle accident, the only way you can sue me is by doing the long-arm statute first, as opposed to serving me personally, even though I'm the valid personal representative of the estate?
I think it depends on the ordering of when the complaint is first filed. If it was not filed before the opening of the estate, then I think the administratrix could be served directly after having the estate open for purposes of following it up. I agree that I think that my understanding would be that they could do that. There might be an issue of the statute of limitations having run by the time they made that filing, and that would be a separate issue. But I think they could proceed as Your Honor suggests. In this instance, with Mr. Foes, he had died so many years before the estate was opened. I think a statute of limitations issue would arise, but I think because of the way the long-arm statute is written and because of the way the plaintiff had proceeded in starting to go through all the requirements of it, they didn't complete the requirements as the statute contemplated it with respect to a defendant dying midpoint in the process. That's why I raised that point and read that particular section of the language, because it seems to contemplate if you file the complaint on the defendant who subsequently thereafter dies, then you can serve it on the estate just by repeating the process. But it contemplates that the defendant would have been served before he died. That's how I see the language, and that's why I am where I am.
So I guess it's your position that the first complaint was dismissed just because service couldn't be accomplished. Then when the second complaint was filed and they tried to accomplish service under the long-arm statute, you recited paragraph 4 of your motion to dismiss. They tried service under 8118, but that was unsuccessful. And then you go on to recite the rest of the facts. Apparently, it's this paragraph 4 in your motion to dismiss that prompted Judge Cooch to have this colloquy at the argument that led to the supplemental briefing.
I think that's what prompted it, because the issue of service or how it was accomplished or not accomplished, which we viewed as fundamental to the failure to prosecute part of it, it also raised naturally all of those other subjects, and that further developed into the request by Judge Cooch for further briefing on it.
Well, is there any indication in the record why you didn't address that in the motion to dismiss? In reading paragraph 4, knowing what we know now after the supplemental briefing and the briefing in this case, it would seem when you're reciting that the second complaint was filed and long-arm service was attempted and it was unsuccessful, this paragraph would have continued and said, therefore, it's inappropriate to join me as the administratrix, because if we read the plain language of the statute, failure to accomplish service during the lifetime of the decedent precludes service on an administratrix.
I can't explain why that wasn't raised or addressed at that point in time. Probably it wasn't because it wasn't felt it was necessary to get to that point. There were so many other hurdles or roadblocks before you got there that maybe it didn't need to be addressed, and it wasn't. But I do note, retrospectively, as you pointed out, and looking at the full picture of it, there is a difficulty with the service on the administratrix, even if you get past all those other hurdles.
But that difficulty also would be resolved if it were deemed that you waived the objection of lack of personal jurisdiction.
Well, As I argued earlier, it may have been waived on our part as the defendant moving to dismiss for that purpose, but I don't see that the court, sua sponte, would have its authority waived to come to that conclusion based on its own review of the record. And I think Judge Cooch in this case, in looking at the record, came to that conclusion quite on his own, looking at it from the point of view of the court and whether or not do we indeed have personal jurisdiction over this plaintiff.
But then that would get me back to the question I raised earlier, which is that if Rule 12 says either you raise these defenses or you lose them, and then you're saying that under Rule 41, well, the court can still look at any of these same defenses that were waived and say, well, I'm going to dismiss on the basis of one of these defenses. Doesn't that put Rule 41 in direct conflict with Rule 12?
Well, I believe Rule 12 is not absolute. I mean, it recommends quite strongly, and it directs the parties to raise these affirmative defenses in these particular six subject areas, that it should be raised in their response of pleading or by motion. And it says a motion making any of these defenses shall be made before pleading if a further pleading is permitted. In our instance, there was no further pleading to be permitted. We filed our answer. There was no counterclaim or cross-claims that required any further pleadings in the case. And so it would seem that the language of Rule 12B would permit further motion to add or subtract a defense.
Mm-hmm. And that goes back to Justice Berger's question earlier about the difference between personal jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction. And we can consider this a hypothetical, so you don't have to worry about it in the context of this case. And but let's assume there were very similar facts, and someone simply enters their appearance and files a motion to dismiss for other grounds, knowing full well that they could have asserted this lack of service. They just decide to waive that because they have a better argument to make. It seems that the logical extension of what you're asking for here is that a court can reject your waiver of personal service, even though you want to waive personal service and enter an appearance. Now, that would make sense if the jurisdiction was subject matter because you can't confer jurisdiction on a court. But if an individual or their wants to submit to the jurisdiction of the court, I've never seen a case where the court says, well, we're not going to allow you to submit to our jurisdiction.
I understand your Honor's hypothetical, and I think, in fact, similar to this case or identical to this case, if that situation were to arise, I think it would be incumbent on the court, or more relevantly, on the party, to make a proper motion to amend, which I think is permitted quite clearly. Mullen v. Alarmgard certainly permits a party to amend a pleading, including adding affirmative defenses. And it seems that they can do it at any reasonable time if the court, in its discretion, thinks it's appropriate. I think within that context of the permissibility of amendment of a pleading, it would permit, if that were done, at whose recommendation, it could be the defendants or it could be the courts. In Judge Cooch's case, he seemed to suggest that it could really come from the court, that change could be overcome or that impediment could be overcome. But it would require ultimately an amendment that the court would have to rule on in its discretion whether or not it was appropriate.
But wouldn't the statute of limitations have run so there would have been no way for the plaintiffs to cure
their personal service issue? In this instance, because the accident happened so long before, the case had been dismissed once, languished for a year, then it was refiled, and then it was over 2.5 years after the refiling under the savings statutes that the case came back in. I think the statute of limitations would have arisen as an additional issue. It wasn't addressed because there were all the other issues that seemed to take priority in everyone's mind when they filed their motions. But statute of limitations, I think, clearly would be an issue here as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning again, Your Honor. I just wanted to make a comment about Rule 41E and the court's authority to dismiss. That is true, but there were many opportunities for the trial court to dismiss this case pursuant to its authority on Rule 41E before the defendant ever appeared and raised the failure to prosecute motion, and the court declined to do that. And in fact, with the court's October order requiring that the plaintiff perform those three items, one may ask, why would the court ask those three things to be done if there was a viable reason for them to dismiss the case based upon violation of the 7-day rule for serving the defendant?
Can I ask you, what happened in that post, the supplemental briefing after the issue of the propriety of the way the service was accomplished? That had been raised in their response, their reply brief, so to speak. And the court said, okay, let's have supplemental submissions on that point. At that point, what did you argue?
I believe that they were arguing, Your Honor, about perfection of service under the long-arm statute. I think it's important to recall that the long-arm statute, if one looked at it with a large picture, it's kind of designed to permit plaintiffs to serve defendants that are not really around Delaware anymore. And the service is actually perfected on the Secretary of State, and as a courtesy, so to speak, a notice is sent to the defendant. And the trial court acknowledged in their opinion that it may very well be that the defendant never gets that letter. But nonetheless, the court said the statute is the statute and that must be applied.
So you argued simply that the statute could be interpreted to allow you not to follow step two?
Well, I believe that, our position was that any deficiency under the initial 7-day rule was cured by the appointment of the executor for the estate, service on her, and everything was put right by following the court's October order. In that case, and the court had ample opportunity to dismiss the rule under Rule 41 prior to the defendant ever arriving on the scene. And in terms of delay and prejudice in this case, I think it's important to note that this case involved a rear-end collision by a drunk driver. So there's no real question about liability from our viewpoint. It's a question of what are the damages. And that could be proved through medical records and testimony of the plaintiff. And the fact that the defendant has deceased and is no longer around is of little import or minimal prejudice to the defendant's case in this matter. I would thank the court for its time, and I would ask that the court reverse the lower court's decision and reinstate the matter for trial.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we'll also take a brief recess.
Please rise.